Doctors Without Borders recently released their seventh annual top 10 most underreported humanitarian stories of 2004. And on our underreported feature today, I'm joined by Nicholas De Torrente, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders, who will share notes on these issues. Welcome to the Leonard LoPage Show.
Thank you, Leonard.
Now, the list is 9 countries and a disease.
That's right. The list that we've put out now for 7 years, as you mentioned, really tries to the starting point is the experience of our field teams. We have teams who are trying to provide medical humanitarian aid in the worst places to help the people who are most affected and in greatest need. And we want to draw attention, I think, to the mismatch between what they're experiencing and what is being covered in the mainstream press, to draw attention to the crises themselves and to that mismatch, and to try to, you know, put these issues back into the spotlight. And we work mainly in war zones, and so because war has and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, an incredibly devastating impact on people. And so the list is dominated by nine chronic conflicts, and by one disease, tuberculosis, which is skyrocketing now in the era of AIDS as a disease associated with AIDS.
On this show, we have been covering underreported news stories each week for 6 months now, and I guess I shouldn't be surprised at how much overlap there is. We have approached them mostly from a political point of view, but as you suggest, the political and the humanitarian are totally linked.
Well, that's right, because even to deliver effective assistance to people in need, there needs to be some kind of attention, media attention, and political attention. To take an example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, for instance, there is no pressure on the various factions, they have a free hand, basically, to do whatever they want with a population. And this means violence, abuse, sexual violence, rape, and so on. And there's no accountability whatsoever for that. And this prevents, of course, affects people and prevents also assistance from reaching them in a good way. So there's clearly a link between the level of attention and political attention and even the ability of aid organizations to deliver assistance.
When you're drawing up the list, are you doing some serious analysis, or is this just a list of the places that you see as being in the worst crisis but not being paid much attention to?
Well, it is a list from our subjective vantage point, from our experience, as I mentioned at the start. However, if you look at some objective indicators, we have looked at the news coverage that the three main broadcast news networks in the U.S. In their nightly news shows, you know, pay to these crises, and we have found that basically a minute out of over 14,000 minutes of coverage was devoted to any one of these issues. So 1 minute out of 14,000, it's staggering. So we're
compare
not missing
that to Trace to Tracy Peterson's killing, or Martha Stewart, or Michael Jackson, and it's really stunning, isn't it?
It's absolutely stunning, and it's shocking because there is really no justification for that. The most commonly advanced justification is that people are not interested in this, and that therefore the news media should not invest resources and effort into trying to cover these stories. And I think that's patently false when you look at the interest of people, you know, as they reported to us, as they reported to you. You were just mentioning in your introduction that your underreported segment has received a lot of a big following and a lot of attention, and I think that proves the point, that people are actually interested in this,
as we saw when with the reaction to the tsunami. But that story was reported heavily and people responded well. There have been many reasons given for the lack of reporting in many in these instances. Often it's because so many of the countries involved are in Africa, and there's a feeling that the West is less interested in people who are dark-skinned.
Well, there's definitely a bias in international news coverage for areas that are considered strategic from a political point of view. And you can see that, of course, the Middle East, the little international news that is in the, that is covered in the U.S. is the Middle East, Iraq, of course, and Africa, as you note, received very scant attention. I mean, even the news organizations that would like, that we consider, you know, would like to pay more attention to these areas are underreporting it. The New York Times has a handful of correspondents. Even NPR has less than a handful of correspondents to cover Africa. So it's really quite distressing.
North Korea has been in the news quite a bit. Why did it make it into your list?
Well, because we continue to be very concerned about the situation for the population in North Korea. The attention has been on the nuclear crisis and the potential for destabilization of the Korean Peninsula and so on and so forth. But we have not paid much attention to what's happening to the people of North Korea. And we have a very limited vantage point there. We decided a few years ago that we could not provide effective aid in North Korea. We cannot verify that our aid was actually reaching the most needy because of the way the regime represses and controls aid. But we do see, refugees who are fleeing North Korea and who take enormous risks to do so. They arrive in China, and there is a repression there of the networks that try to help them on the part of the Chinese authorities.
In support of North Korea?
Well,
or did they just want to discourage these
refugees
from coming into China?
Of course, they want to discourage the refugees from coming in, so they put obstacles on the border itself, and then they basically consider all Koreans coming into North Korea, into China, as economic migrants. Don't recognize that they're fleeing persecution and extreme hardship in North Korea, and they want to send them back. So they don't want to do anything that could destabilize North Korea, and the people are bearing the brunt of that policy.
Well, there's also the problem in the fact that North Korea is so secretive, so it's hard to report on a country that doesn't really allow anybody in or give them access to what's going on in the country.
Absolutely, and that's our small window into North Korea is the refugees. And in fact, you could make that case for a number of these countries where it's difficult to report. I mean, there are reasons why it is hard to get news. I mean, it is difficult to report. A lot of these places, there's access problems due to the authorities in place, due to insecurity, and there are objective problems for reporters, and many of them take great risk. Actually, a lot of journalists are taking a lot of risks to try to bring the story.
In places like Chechnya, for example.
Absolutely, in places like Chechnya, where this was the one context that received a little bit of attention last year, linked to the siege in Beslan and the killings there. But what is happening inside Chechnya is very worrisome, in the sense that people are being pressure to return into a situation that continues to be extremely violent, and that affects the population. But as you mentioned, also aid organizations were trying to deliver assistance and journalists reporting.
Are humanitarian crises more likely to be overlooked in Africa, or are there just more humanitarian issues in Africa?
I think both.
We're overwhelmed, aren't we? After a while, you hear about this one, that one, the other one. They start all merging together.
Well, I think that's also it has to do with the way these crises are reported. If they're reported in a very a superficial way, another war, another massacre, another famine, then of course people's eyes will glaze over. But you do need to devote the resources and attention to understand. Of course, these are complex places and these are complex issues, but I think journalists can do a good job of doing that. We've seen it for Iraq, for instance. I mean, did any of us know very much about what was happening in Iraq, or the complexities of the politics and the social makeup and the what's at stake in Iraq before a few years ago? No one, hardly anyone did, only specialists. Now all of us know the names of Sistani and the other major political players. It should be possible to do the same for the Congo or for Sudan.
This is the seventh year you've compiled the list. Do you tend to cover the same regions year after year?
Well, that's one of the shocking aspects of the list for us, is that we've put some countries such as the Democratic Republic of Congo or Colombia on the list.
Somalia is another one.
Somalia as well for 6 years running. And, you know, I think these are markers of the level of the crisis and also the level of inattention. And we ignore these crises at the peril of the people who are suffering them. To give you an example, Darfur was at the top of our list in 2003. It was the biggest underreported crisis. We had seen refugees come into Chad at that time in 2003. No one was paying attention. Well, we all know now what has been happening in Darfur. Crimes against humanity on a very, very large scale. And, we could have paid attention to this much earlier, and we failed to, and a lot of people are dead or living in extremely bad situation as a result.
So Sudan is no longer on the list, even though there is still a crisis there.
Yes. The reason it's not on the list in 2004 is that by the summer of 2004, there was some media attention and political attention and related to that, more humanitarian assistance that was allowed to come in Darfur. But if we were to make the list today, we would put it on the list again because the media spotlight has gone away, but the crisis remains an extremely concerning situation in Darfur now, and a deteriorating one fighting continuing and persecution continuing and displacement continuing, especially in parts of Darfur, in South Darfur, North Darfur. And today, were we to drop this list, Darfur would definitely make it.
Did the generous response to the tsunami crisis make you hopeful at all?
Yes, of course, definitely. It showed how that people care, and that the media can play a positive role in highlighting the plight and making this connection between the victims. Well, this is what is missing. I mean, if you consider Congo or Sudan as abstract terms, and you cannot put a face, you cannot put a story, you cannot put individuals, you cannot put a life. You know, lives you cannot relate to those, then it's very hard to make a connection when you're in the United States. The media was able to do this with the tsunami, and people were touched by it. And I think our challenge is to extend that spirit and that solidarity to other places around the world.
It was also the dramatic aspect of the tragedy. There have been some things over the last 10 years or so that have claimed a lot more lives. Earthquake in India, China, Iran has had a number of devastating earthquakes, and they haven't been paid the same kind of attention.
Well, there is more attention to natural disasters because of this kind of overwhelming impact, very sudden, very unexpected, and everyone, you know, being caught up in it. We can all represent ourselves as being the victims of that disaster. Had we been on the beach in Sri Lanka or in Indonesia, I think it's more difficult for other types of crises. But as you mentioned, in terms of numbers and the devastation, I mean, there's a tsunami every month or so related to AIDS in Africa. I mean, this is the number of AIDS patients who've died of AIDS in South Africa alone in 2004 is equivalent to the number of deaths of the tsunami, and we have not taken a measure of that.
But AIDS didn't make your top 10 list this year. We will come back, and I'll go over the list, and we'll look at some of these places in more detail. My guest is Nicholas De Torrenti, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders. We are looking at the Doctors Without Borders top 10 most underreported humanitarian stories of 2004. Stay with us. We're back on WNYC 93.9 AM 820 online at WNYC.org. My guest is Nicholas De Torrenti, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders. and they have issued their top 10 most underreported humanitarian stories of 2004. We thought it would be appropriate to talk about that on our underreported series. So let's go through the list. Northern Uganda, Congo, Colombia, tuberculosis, Somalia, Chechnya, Burundi, North Korea, Ethiopia, and Liberia. Now, Liberia seemed to have stabilized a couple of years ago. In 2003, when Charles Taylor was ousted, everybody was quite hopeful. What's happened there?
Well, the situation has improved in Liberia since that time. The 2003, as you mentioned, was a terrible year for Liberia in the sense that the conflict came to Monrovia itself, and it had a huge impact there. We're concerned about the fact that the situation remains very unstable in Liberia and very precarious. We have, there remains a large number of people displaced internally in the country who have not been able to return to their homes. A lot of people as well, about 300,000 in neighboring countries who have not been able yet to return. So although there is some progress, there's a lot of instability and a lot of uncertainty about the future. There's a disarmament process that took place. It's incomplete. The structures to accommodate people returning are very limited. There are 30 doctors in Liberia today for a population of 3 million, and you can see how the shortfall there. So we just want to stress the fact that when things stabilize slightly, and there's a peace agreement, and there seems to be progress, we need to continue to pay attention, because otherwise things can slip back very easily.
How can there be just 30 doctors in a whole country?
People have left. This is there's an exodus of health staff in Africa in general. They're being tempted by better conditions in Europe and other places, and are trying to get out. And in a country at war, that's exacerbated because they're not paid well by their ministries of health. There's not enough support for the health system in most African countries. And on top of that, Liberia was at war, and for a lot of people, including health staff, I mean, they wanted to find a safer place and to live and raise their families, and a lot of them have left.
Well, you've been forced to leave a number of the countries you have been involved in. Afghanistan, Iraq as well. Weren't you also in Chechnya?
Yes, we have 2004, and this is not on the list because there, of course, has been a lot of attention to Iraq and Afghanistan. But it's true that in both of those countries we've been forced to leave as a result of targeted attacks against humanitarian aid workers. We had 5 colleagues killed in Afghanistan in June of last year. There've been
anybody know who did it? Should we just say it's all the remnants of the Taliban, or is the situation there more complicated?
It's more complex. The Taliban claimed responsibility and said that we were serving the cause of the United States, and therefore we would continue to be attacked. However, it seems more likely that a local political leader / military leader who was allied with the Kabul government actually carried this out to draw attention to his grievances against the government. We have not been able to return because there's a kind of impunity against this individual and others on the part of the authorities who have not investigated properly. So we are not, and the threat of the Taliban remains. And Afghanistan and in Iraq, we are not the only organization, of course, who's been attacked. There have been many, many other aid workers killed and wounded and kidnapped in these countries.
Well, your organization is really based in France, so you are not arms of the U.S. government. You've made it quite clear that you're not arms of any government, that what you do is totally separate from any kind of a governmental approach. So do people believe you?
Well, we're having clearly having a hard time getting that message across. I mean, the results bear that out in the field. I mean, that we're not able to stay in the places where the U.S. Is actively waging war and has associated all humanitarian organizations, or tried to, with its political and military efforts. So although we are based, we're an international organization with members around the world, although we have we're not taking any U.S. government funding, and we haven't done so for several years now, although we are privately supported by individuals, although we steer clear of all government and religious and economic influences in deciding what we do and how we do it, we are still perceived by these extremist groups as Western, and that is something that we have to continue to work very hard on to try to make that distinction.
We heard a lot about problems in Ethiopia in the 1980s. Now it's on your list. What happened?
Well, in Ethiopia, what we're concerned about is the fact that there's recurrent bouts of malnutrition that affect different parts of the country, and that although the country receives a lot of food aid, that has not gone away. The government wants to resettle people into more fertile and areas, but the conditions for that are not conducive, and have not been met, in particular in terms of medical care. And so we want to continue to draw attention to that, to the possibility that people may not receive the right level of assistance in the places that they're being resettled to.
Is there still conflict with Eritrea, the country that broke off from Ethiopia?
Not active fighting at the moment.
But there was for a while.
Yes.
That, I'm sure, exacerbated the situation.
For the moment, the front line has been quiet. I think it's more a question of political negotiations and that have not been finalized.
And Chechnya, which got a lot of press attention for a while, is back on your list. Have we just moved on to some other crises?
But I'm sorry,
Chechnya is,
yes,
is on the list again.
Yes, it's on the list again, because we need to continue to realize what's happening inside the country for ordinary people who are being pressured to return. A lot of the displaced who were in neighboring countries have now gone back, but the insecurity is there, is still very high. This is really what we're trying to draw attention to. I mean, is the fate of ordinary people who are caught up in these wars, who are caught in the middle, who are trying to just to make a living and fend for themselves, and who are being pressured on all sides, and who are not being who are not considered in the political decisions and in the media coverage decisions.
So, if these crises continue, what do you think will happen in places like Congo, Somalia, or Colombia?
Well, if they continue, the toll that they're taking on ordinary people will continue to be shockingly high, and as I mentioned earlier with Darfur, you know, there is a possibility to at least improve things slightly for people if there's more attention that is paid. And we ignore these these crises at the expense of people's lives. And I think that's what we are trying to bring across here, is that we can't afford to ignore them, not for reasons of national security or other kind of broader geostrategic reasons, but basically just for the simple reason that if we ignore them, ordinary people like you and I, have to endure things that are really unacceptable. People, soldiers coming to their home and raping women, forced to sleep outside. These are all things that we see every day in all of our field projects, and that we just continue to find intolerable, and we want to draw attention to them.
My guest is Nicholas Di Torrenti, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders. He is talking about Doctors Without Borders' top 10 most underreported humanitarian stories of 2004 as part of our underreported series here on the Leonard Lopate Show. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Over the years, you've also included epidemics in your list. In 2003, malaria was there, and I assume that malaria continues to be a major underreported story.
It's It's a major underreported story. There is good news on the malaria front, however, in the sense that most countries now and most international donors who support the health budgets of these affected countries, in particular in Africa, have decided to shift to a more effective treatment called artemisinin combination therapy, which actually works. It's a drug that actually works, as opposed to the ones that had been used until then and continue to be used in some parts, such as chloroquine, which just does not work any longer. And so there has been a shift. The question now is really to get the supply of the drug and to maintain that supply so people can actually be treated with the drug in the field. But there is at least positive momentum. It's really quite the opposite with tuberculosis, which is on our list this year, and that's why we're trying to draw attention to it.
Well, we tend to think of it as something of the past. We've pretty much conquered tuberculosis in this country, haven't we?
In this country, there are less cases, although they have been increasing, and there was even a multi-drug-resistant TB epidemic in New York City a few years ago, so it's definitely not off the radar screen in the United States either. But in the developing world, the number of cases has really increased dramatically in the past couple of years. There's a strong link with the HIV/AIDS pandemic. TB is the most common opportunistic infection for associated with HIV, and so as AIDS has increased and the efforts to stem the pandemic have not borne fruit yet, TB has increased as well.
And again, mostly in Africa, or are we also seeing it in Asia as China becomes a problem?
We are seeing it in other countries as well. We're seeing it in there's a very big epidemic and documented epidemic in Russia and in other and in neighboring countries.
I understand the Inuit population. How did that happen?
I'm not aware of that, of that particular case. But TB is on the rise, and the real problem we face is that the tools that we have at our disposal to treat TB, to diagnose it and then treat it, are hopelessly out of date and antiquated and ineffective, inappropriate. We have the diagnosis method is a sputum test. We ask people to spit up and then we analyze that. This test was invented in 1882. So over 100 years ago. There's nothing better that's been developed yet, and it does not detect TB in patients with AIDS, because most of that TB is extrapulmonary as opposed to pulmonary.
Hasn't a new strain just developed recently that is more resistant to antibiotics or the usual treatments?
What happens is that when the TB treatment is very long, it's a combination of many drugs. It's 6 months treatment at the minimum, and therefore people drop off and don't complete their treatment. That leads to resistant strains of TB. This is what is called polyresistant or multi-drug resistant TB, and that has increased dramatically. It's very hard to treat. It's extremely expensive, several thousand dollars per patient to treat. So basically what we need is it can also be spread. There can also be a multi-drug resistant TB epidemic from one MDR TB patient to another. That's happened as well in numerous places. So what we need is a much better regimen to treat TB, a shorter regimen that will decrease the risk of people dropping out and then fueling resistance to TB.
Is there enough money to take care of all of these things? I know after the tsunami, we heard that in some cases, places were flooded with food and equipment, food that was rotting on the docks. Are we too generous in some places and too stingy in others?
Well, I think that just to come back to TB, I mean, on TB, for instance, the resources are completely inadequate, and for research and development for most neglected diseases such as TB, malaria, and others, definitely there's not enough that's being done, not enough investment, not enough research that's happening. So yes, we do need much more. There is a question, yes, of how decisions are, how funds are raised, and how decisions are made on where to allocate them. There is a glaring mismatch between the level of a need in some places, and there are available resources. And the response to the tsunami, which how incredibly generous as it was. I mean, I have a question on how effectively we collectively will be able to spend all of this money. It's the outpouring has been so tremendous, and I mean. At Doctors Without Borders, we've said early on that we felt that the response from the public was so great and generous that our operations were funded, and are asking people and have asked people and continue to give us the permission to use these funds for other crises around the world that are out of the media spotlight and that are not getting also the government funding that other places are receiving, such as South Asia.
Who are these annual lists aimed at? Have they made much of a difference over the years?
They're aimed at the media to start off with. So I'm very glad to be invited to this show and to others. I think that it's interesting for me to see that a lot of journalists, in fact, would like to cover these stories a lot more, but they are in. Media establishment and industry where editorial choices are made on other criteria, on economic criteria, on ratings, on the presumed interests of the public, and therefore they're not allowed. I mean, I remember very well a couple of years back we were facing a massive famine in Angola that was completely off the radar screen, and we were sending desperate messages to journalists, and I remember a message that our director of communications wrote to CNN in bold letters in an email, why CNN must go to Angola. They never went. And not because the journalists didn't want to go, because of the corporate hierarchy that did not want to devote the resources for that. It was not a priority. So journalists are actually interested in this. It's a way for them to attract attention and to try to get their leadership to change perspective.
Just one more thing. Have I been mispronouncing your name?
No, not at all.
Oh, because I was told it might be De Torrente after all these years of calling you Torrente.
I think it's De Torrente in English.
Oh, okay. Well, but
I don't know how
would
to
you
pronounce
say it
my own name.
Nicholas De Torrente or Torrent, either way. He's executive director of Doctors Without Borders, and my great thanks to him for being a guest today again on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Many thanks to you, Leonard.